So the paper that I'm going to be talking about is something that I wrote. It's a local product. It's a I wrote with David Bernstein, Chris Herzog, and Sam Panensky in May, and there were was closely two other papers with very similar conclusions appeared at basically the same time, one by Hanani's MIT group and one by this Italian group. I'm very jealous of their number. So we've already heard a lot of talks recently about Sasaki-Einstein spaces and Kruber gauge theories, and just to give you a 5 or 3 minute summary of what we've heard, these theories are generically described by a quiver diagram where there's some number of nodes, where each of the nodes corresponds to some gauge group. And so in the cases we've been seeing, these gauge groups have been SUN. And there are links between these nodes, directed links, which correspond to some number of bifundamental matter fields. And what we've been seeing is that these are actually dual in an ABS CFT sense to these superconformal gauge theories are dual in this ABS CFT sense to geometries which are of the form ABS 5 times X5, where X5 is Sasaki-Einstein, which basically means that if you take the metric cone over it, the resulting six-dimensional space is Calabi-Yau. In particular, the examples that we've been hearing a lot about recently are these, are where this Sasaki-Einstein space X5 is one of, is an example of this family of Sasaki-Einstein spaces called YPQ. And one of the impressive things about this class of spaces is that we know explicit metrics on them, and we also, thanks to a lot of work by Hanani and his collaborators, we know what the dual gauge theories are quite explicitly. So, so this is great. It vastly widens the class of spaces that we can study using ABS-CFT, which is really interesting from the physics point of view. We can do lots of checks of this correspondence. And from a mathematical point of view, we have all these interesting spaces where we can study their properties very explicitly. And so that's pretty interesting too. But from a physics point of view, what's really interesting about having more examples is if we can find new phenomena in these setups, or if we can get a new way of understanding some old phenomena. And that's going to be the subject of this talk. This is going to be a physics talk. I'm going to try to avoid using the word torque. And unlike Eva Silverstein, I'm not going to apologize for that. Okay. So that's true. I said I was going to try. So in all the examples that we've seen so far, the gauge groups at these nodes have been SUN. And in just about every talk that we have on this, somebody asks, what happens if these gauge groups aren't all SUN? And this is going to be one of the, this is basically the subject of this talk. Okay. So, I'm going to specialize to a particular example in this talk. It's going to be where the Sasaki-Einstein space is the space Y21, and the associated Calabi-Yau is a complex cone. Over the first null tensor, which you can just think of as CP2 blown up with a P1 blown up at one point. in that space. And to start out, we'll characterize this theory by taking the conformal case. So this theory has a particularly simple quiver. It's a four-node quiver. And in this conformal case, we have SUN all the nodes. There's also Black fundamental matter. There's a number of fields which are, there are a number of fields which form SE2 doublets, so alpha equals 1 and 2. And then there are a bunch of singlets. And let me make sure that I have all these arrows pointing the right ways. So there are these fields U. There are two U fields, which are SE2 doublets. There's an SE2 doublet V, and then there are these Y fields and a Z field. And so loops in the quiver can be thought of as strings of operators which begin and end in the same place, so you can trace over them and get gauge invariant operators. And there's a simple, well, relatively simple superpotential that you can write down, where each term is a loop in the quiver. I'm just going to write this down. So as you can see, it's not that bad. And there's an implicit trace over these guys that I'm just not going to write. One thing you can check about this quiver is that it's free of gauge anomalies. When you have SUN on each of these nodes, that just means that you have the same number of arrows going in as the same number going out. This theory has a superconformal fixed point. And at that point, you can compute the R charges of all these fields using A maximization. And it's all very nice. So this is the theory that we're going to study. It's and one thing that's particularly interesting to look at this is the space of gauge invariant operators. So as I was saying before, these just correspond to loops in the quiver, and so they form, these are things like the trace of, for example, you can have UL, UL1, Y1, Y3, or any such other object. There are some simple relations amongst these which you get. Well, actually, let me talk about the Kyle ring first. So when we discuss the operators in this theory, it's useful to use a construction which is called the chiral ring. Where we restrict attention to chiral operators, which are those which are annihilated by the supercharges of one chirality. So T bar alpha dot kills these operators. And this has the useful property that if you, of course, if you have a supersymmetric vacuum, then Q bar alpha dot acting on the vacuum is zero. And it has the useful property that they form a ring when I take correlation functions. So the product of chiral operators is chiral. And I can consider equivalence classes
which are basically all these operators up to two-part commutators. And the important property that I'm going to use from all of this structure is that these, when I take correlation functions of these operators, they're independent of position. So the spatial derivative of one of these operators is a two-bar commutator. So these details aren't really important, but the if you want to do this properly, then this is the construction that you use. And the operators that I'm considering are of the form of traces. Of these five fundamental fields. And really more properly, the true color operators are really polynomials in these traces. But just to be schematic, I'm going to write them like this. They have a natural so when I write down these operators, they have a natural interpretation in the dual supergravity sign. Basically, because this space is Calabi-Yau, if I take D3 brains and move them around in space, moving D3 brains around doesn't break any additional supersymmetry. So there's a moduli space corresponding to those D3 brains, and you can match that up to the moduli space of these operators, which I won't do in detail here, but I'm going to just quickly describe how you would go about doing that. And there's a point. There's a reason why I'm doing this. So first of all, whenever I write down some of these operators, say a product of these gauge invariant operators, or just the operators by themselves, I can simplify them by using the F-term relations of this gauge theory. So there's a set of F-terms given by differentiating the superpotential with respect to some of these fields, and that gives you zero. So for example, I can vary the superpotential with respect to y, and what I get is a relation like UL1 V2 equals UL2 V1. And to form a gauge invariant operator, say, I can multiply both sides by Y1. And then take the trace. So one thing you notice is that if I write down all of the, say I write down all of the gauge invariant operators that loop once around this quiver, I'll have relations of this form, which are, say, linear in these operators, which reduces the number of independent operators. So linear order, you reduce the number of operators to 9. And I'm not going to do that out, but it's true. You can also consider these guys at quadratic order. And again, because it's algebraically tedious, I'm not going to do it, but it's quite simple. For example, by applying these F-term relations, you can show, for example, that there's this loop, Y2, Y3 times an object of this form, so you can get relations of this form. And it turns out that when you do this, you get a number of relations between the one loop, these single trace one loop operators. And in particular, what you find is that there are 20 relations.
How do you find this number?
You just write out all of the equations and you count them.
So what do you do for y 75?
It's a mess.
You don't have a group theory way of computing the number of relations?
I'm sure there is, but I don't know what it is.
If it's torque, you can count the number of relations using torque methods, but I don't know how to do it in the algebra.
You don't want to use torque methods.
Right, and he doesn't want to use torque methods.
I'm trying to avoid that word.
Actually, I think I know the number for relations for any WebEQ.
Oh, good. You can tell me later.
In terms of
mm-hmm. Okay. So there's basically one thing that I want to get out of this, which is that I have 9 independent operators which characterize the geometry of my space. But I have 20 relations between them, which naively would say that this space seems to be over-constrained. But in fact, these relations are not independent. They're related to each other such that you wind up with just 3 independent degrees of freedom, as you would expect, because these D3 brains are probing a Calabi-Yes space. But you can't reduce the number of, it turns out that you can't reduce the number of this number of relations and get something non-trivial. So this is what's known as an incomplete intersection. Variety.
It's true that there is something known as a complete intersection variety, which is the opposite case. But
yes.
But this term is not a term.
Oh, people don't use that term. Okay. So it's not a complete intersection.
Not a complete intersection.
Thank you.
Remember reading physics language, not math language.
So in most of the Calabi-Yes that we know and love, we have complete intersections. You have some number of equations. Say for the conifold, you have equations in C4. There's one equation that reduces you to a 3 complex dimensional space. Here, that doesn't work, and there's a very important implication of that.
But it looks like then there's a lot of non-uniqueness, right? There's it is very ambiguous. Then it is not very clear how, for a given number of relations and operators, you will always reproduce the same space, or whether the space can be reproduced using
What you need is the relations among the relations, for which there is a term called syzygy. And then you need the relations among the relations among the relations, and then you need the relations among the relations among the relations among the relations. And this is the same thing as ghosts and ghosts for ghosts in BRST theory. You know, it's exactly the same algebraic manipulation. Completely unique.
Yes.
You have some generic function which comes this.
Well, that process stops at the dimension of variety. Okay.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. So there's something very important about this. So in the case that we all know and love, you have the conifold, which is given by this equation in C4, and it was easy to deform its complex structure. You just take this equation and you add a constant on the other side, and there's no problem with that. You can't do that in a simple way for this space, because you have these 20 relations and only 9 variables, so if you try to deform some of them, you have to deform all of the others to do that consistently, and in general, that might not be possible. It turns out that it's not possible in this space. There's a theorem due to a mathematician named Altman, which says there are, in fact, no complex structure deformations. Okay.
Assumption.
Oh, I didn't. I would have to look at the paper and sure about myself. I think.
What do you mean by complex patch information?
Basically, where you take these complex equations and you try to add additional terms. You try to deform them as you would deform this, as you would add a term to this deformed Kolmogorov equation. And yeah.
That's saying you can't describe them, or they don't exist. Really?
They don't exist.
So you take the 20 relations and you attempt to make a complex deformation to find what's inconsistent.
So you have to deform the relations among the relations, obviously, at the same time. That's the essence of
the problem. Oh, but that then would be a complex structure deformation just coming from a different place.
No, I mean, you try to deform the relations, but they have to be, in order to get the three-dimensional variety, there have to be consistency conditions among the relations,
yes,
which are represented by the syzygies.
Yes.
So you have to deform the syzygies as well as deforming the relations in a consistent way so that you still get a three-dimensional variety.
Okay, but then you would have a complex structure.
So the accurate statement is that if you attempted to deform the complex structure, you would lose the dimension of intersection that you're looking for.
Okay.
So if you just took these equations and added terms like an epsilon, like is familiar with the Kolmogorov, then they wouldn't cut out anything except the origin, probably. Mm-hmm. Maybe not even the origin, depending on what the rules would be followed.
Maybe I'm just confused about a simple point, but it looks like you're saying that it's more complicated to deform this way of representing the manifold, namely in terms of these equations, because you have to deform these relations. But if you just look at the manifold, isn't this a complex structure deformation that ultimately one ends up with? Like,
well, the manifold is the set of solutions to these equations.
Yeah.
That's the best way I have to describe the manifold.
Mm-hmm.
So I try to describe any complex structure deformations also as solutions to a similar set of equations. But because the equations are very delicate, I don't just have six equations cutting out a three-dimensional object. I need all 20 equations to cut out the three-dimensional object. And so when you try to perturb them randomly, of course it won't work, right?
So you're saying 20 equations
and 9 variables, I'm not cut out anything.
But we know that there's an intrinsic definition of the manifold. We just may not have it enhanced, you know, in terms of coordinate charts and all that stuff. So
yeah, what I'm telling you is that this is the best way to attack the problem of what is a complex structure deformation.
Oh, okay. You know, so ultimately, though, you do get them via this, or you get.
There aren't any complex structure deformations. This is how you prove it.
Okay, I got it.
If you have any complex structure deformation defined without using the equation, then you would find the sum defined with the equation.
So might there be, for instance, like a completely different manifold that would be defined by 40 relations instead of 20 or less, that you could somehow, without that, it would actually, you could have to put it into, it's difficult to describe how that's related to this in any way that we understand at the moment. Is that what you're trying to do?
You couldn't get there continuously. Like,
yeah, that's the issue. You have to actually change like the number of relations or change them completely, right?
But to change the relation, you have to change this super potential, right?
Yeah.
You would need more fields, for one thing.
You need to change the theory itself.
So let me point out that we don't actually have a manifold. We have a singular space, and that's what we're trying to deform. So even to get started with talking about a singular space, you've got to talk about it as being cut out by a certain number of equations and a certain number of variables. Now, you can ask whether different ways of describing the same singular space is being cut out by some number of equations and some number of variables, but having some abstract isomorphism between the spaces would give the same answer about this deformation problem. And the answer is yes, it would give the same answer. You can do the computation in any of these coordinate systems that you like. It's a very difficult computation. Altman's theorem is a very nice theorem, which applies to exactly the T word comes in, right? Applies to exactly some cases with the T word. And so I'll compute the deformations.
So you want to just specify the theorem? Just how crucial is to keep the Calabi-Yau condition?
This is a purely local result about this kind of singularity. This kind of singularity has no deformations.
Okay.
I plan to prove that in my talk coming up next week. So
right. Sam is going to talk about that
in more detail. I'll go over his theorem completely.
But for instance, if you take y to 0, then it would not be a complete intersection, but you would have complex such a deformation.
The result does not say that every non-complete intersection has no deformations. It's
that's
a very precise result, which applies in this case.
In this case, there happen to be none. In other cases, there may be some, or there may be some other deformations that you would try to do, which would be obstructed.
It's constructed, so if there are deformations, it finds some.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Actually, since you are insisting on doing physics about it, there is a very simple physics criterion for when you have a deformation or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you move to describe this Calabi harmonic in terms of PQ waves, then the condition is just that if you have subwaves or not. Right? If you have subwaves, you are able to deform. If you do not have subwaves, you are not.
Mm-hmm.
So it just maps to our next theorem. Right, but then in your language, you never know whether you have something that is not complex. Maybe it's another pool, but not some sort of order or something. Which is almost possible. So here there's a certain different orders of deformation. Right? First order, second order, mm-hmm. So the subweb story tells you
for any order, I think it's one of the last.
Well, you can keep talking. I'm just. So I'm not going to talk much about supergravity. Leo gave a really nice talk last week about that. But for aficionados of this. Field, just to give you a preview of where this is going, there's the so-called Klebanov-Strassler theory, where I take the theory of D3 brains on the conifold, and then I add some three-form flux, which corresponds to adding some D5 brains. And when I do that, the three-form flux fills a three cycle. And this three cycle, which would have collapsed in the original Calabi Yau case, in the original conifold case, has to be blown up. Which is precisely this complex structure deformation, where I take the conifold and turn it into the deformed conifold. Now, if I try to do the same thing here, I'm going to run into a problem. And that's going to be the subject of the rest of this talk. So let's return to this quiver diagram where I had SUN all these nodes. It turns out that I don't have to put just N of these nodes. But in fact, there's another, I can in fact change the ranks of the gauge group in a way that's still consistent with anomaly cancellation. Where this guy goes to n plus 3m, this guy goes to n plus m, this guy goes to n plus 2m, and this one just stays as SUN. And it's easy to check that this is still anomaly free. There's a better way of making the argument than I'm about to make, but if we just be really sloppy and treat this m as a small number and as a perturbation on the theory that we started out with, we would compute the NSVZ beta functions in the usual way, but with the R charge assignments for these fields given by A maximization, but where the ranks of the gauge group are different. And in general, that's going to change the beta functions. It'll push me away from conformal invariance. There'll be RG flow. And some of these gauge groups will flow the strong coupling. If I want to do this properly, there's some other arguments that you have to make, and there's some things you need to keep track of. But time, life is short. So, again, doing this naively, and we can talk about this more later if you have complaints, the largest gauge group is the one that's going to flow the strong coupling. And notice that NC is n plus 3m, but there are 2 times n plus m flavors. So there are 2 n plus 2m flavors. And that means that I'm in the conformal window. So when this gauge group flows to strong coupling, I should perform a Seiberg duality. So in particular, that means the SUNC with NF flavors goes to SUNF minus NC with NF flavors and some mesons. Okay, so let's see what happens when I do that. I suppose I need to draw this quiver again. Okay, so the fields that don't touch this node are just go along for the ride. So here I have n. I have n plus m, n plus 2m, and this becomes n minus m. I get some additional mesons, which I can think of as being, so for example, between this node and this node, there's a meson which is of the form z ur. So there are going to be 2 new mesons. Along this link of the quiver, I can get mesons which are of the form y2 times ur. So there are going to be 2 new mesons here. And in order to make all this consistent, so these NF flavors still are going to appear, but I have to reverse the direction of the arrows in the quiver. So like this. So this is the new quiver. It turns out that when I look at the superpotential, there's a mass term for these two flavors coupled to these two flavors. So these become massive and go away. And although it may not be completely obvious, if I take these nodes and start and scramble them around, you get exactly the quiver that you started with, but where n goes to n minus m. And this can be done even more systematically, where you actually write out the superpotential. You add the mass terms that are appropriate for Seiberg duality, and then you do all this integrating out. It's at the bottom of this page, but I'm going to skip it. So this cascade is going to keep happening. This gauge group, the m plus 2m group, is going to be the one that flows to strong coupling next. I perform the same process, and each of the gauge groups decrements once more. If I assume that n is a multiple of m, again being very naive, eventually, I'm going to wind up with n equals 0. So this gauge group will be gone. I'll have 3m, 2m, and m, and then associated fields. Pardon?
Can you perform the cyber quality in the last step to kill this very complicated?
It's tricky. We can talk about it later. That's one of the details I'm glossing over. And there's a super potential for these remaining fields. Which is just the one that you inherit from before. And of course, you can't do any more cyber dualities. All this good. So, in this for this triangle theory at the bottom of the cascade, you'd expect this SU3M group to run the strong coupling first, and then it should confine. There are better arguments that there should be confinement somewhere in the theory, but again, life is short, so I'm going to skip this. So what happens when this guy? Let's just suppose that this guy flows to strong coupling. What should I do? Well, at strong coupling, this Y2 and UR will form confined mesons. So this superpotential is going to go to some mesons. Actually, let me write it out. Some mesons like this. And then the natural thing to suppose is that in addition to that, there's an Affleck-Dein-Seiberg type superpotential. Where I think I have my three NCs minus NFs right. Essentially, it's essentially the simplest thing you can write down that's consistent with all the symmetries and of lowest order and various things. And you can study the F-term equations for this and see if you can find a supersymmetric vacuum. Well, it's easy to see what's going to happen now, right? If I vary with respect to V, I get N equals zero. I get that these mesons go to zero. But if I vary with respect to these mesons, well, I get an object like this, and it's lambda to some power. There'll be some minor of the determinant, and then the determinant of m to some power, which is n happens to be this. And it's easy to see that m being driven to zero forces, well, it's impossible to satisfy these equations at finite field networks. Yes?
So here you're using that the SUM and the SU2M group are free.
Yes.
Because you're using thermocouple symbols, but they are gate symbols.
Yes. I'm assuming that this flows to strong coupling and that these guys are weakly coupled. So I'm free to do that. I'll give you a better argument in a second. So, at least at finite field values, supersymmetry is broken. There may be some runaway behavior. It's hard to tell. Of course, when we say that theory has runaway behavior, it means that we're running away from the region where we've done things properly. And so something else might take over somewhere else. But I don't know what that is. It would be more complicated to describe. According to my clock, I have 15 minutes. Is this correct? Okay.
The argument the symmetry is broken is, okay, n equals zero forces.
The determinant has more bounds of n.
Oh, okay. So you can't.
Correct. Right. Okay. Oh, good. I can actually erase some of this stuff now. Of course, we've been very cavalier, right? we've assumed several things along the way. We assumed, for example, this step, that this guy flowed strong coupling and that these guys were weakly coupled. That doesn't have to be true. We assumed that we didn't, for example, hit a superconformal fixed point somewhere else along the flow before we got down there. It turns out that that seems highly unlikely by various other arguments, but again, that's hard to say. When the ranks of these gauge groups become, when n starts getting small, you have to worry that Seiberg duality doesn't quite work in the way that you expect. So there are a lot of subtleties. I'm going to give a slightly better argument for supersymmetry being broken, which is based on the Kanishi anomaly. This will deal with some of the assumptions that I made. It'll take care of the case when these guys are also could possibly also be strongly coupled. It won't deal with all of them. Oh, I should also mention that the caveats that I'm mentioning don't really apply to the conifold. In that case, there's actually a lot more. The theory is simple enough that you can use other arguments to constrain the RG flow. There's a really nice review by Matt Strassler where he does this in excruciating detail. So there are these Kanishi anomaly equations, which are actually very simple and very powerful. And I used to be frightened by them, so I'm going to explain to you how simple they are. So they take the following form. There's this famous 1 over 32 pi squared that tells you that you're dealing with anomalies. And I'll explain what all of these things are in a minute. So these anomaly equations essentially come from taking, you take your path integral, okay, and then you perform a variation of fields. Say I have a field x, I vary it by some function of the fields and possibly of the field strengths. I get this term just simply from varying the F terms. It's just the variation of the superpotential. And this term comes from the anomalous variation of the measure. There's also a term which comes from variation of the D terms, but that term turns out to be a Q-bar commutator. And I can drop that in the Kyle room. OK. So these are basically just Ward identities associated with this transformation. And the calculations that you then have to do are pretty simple. So suppose that you perform in this theory, which I guess is partly erased now. Suppose I perform the variation delta UR1 equals epsilon times the original field. The right-hand side of this equation is just the trace of, I shouldn't have erased the superpotential. But I'm sure you can remember what it is. The right-hand side gives you this. The left-hand side produces terms that look like this. So when I differentiate this guy, there's a derivative, say, of this form, where I'm writing out matrix indices, and then there's an overall matrix index for this whole object, I and j, which is traced over. And then you just put all the indices back in, and then there are other terms. This term actually just produces, for example, so this index I can treat this guy as a matrix. And then this, the lower index here is just this I. Say upper index L. the derivative of this matrix, let's say, has a lower index L and upper index J, and then I differentiate. And then the differentiation produces delta, Kronecker deltas. The fact that I'm multiplying on the left, well, so I get a delta Li, which gives me the trace of this. So there's going to be a 1 over 32 pi squared trace W alpha, where this is evaluated in one of the gauge groups. And I get a delta JJ. So for example, this might be evaluated in the SU3M gauge group. But then the trace over the other index gives me a factor of M. So in particular, when I work all this stuff out, I'll get an M times S3, where S3 is a Gluino condensate for this SU3M gauge group. And it turns out that you just get the same term for the other gauge group, where there's a 3M from tracing over the SU3M indices and Gluino condensate for the SUM gauge group. It's that easy. And then you do this for all the other guys. And because I'm running short of time, I won't write them out. But what you see when you do all of this is that it's impossible to satisfy all of the equations that you write down at the same time unless all the S's are zero. And with the assumption that confinement happens somewhere, and assuming a supersymmetric vacuum, then at least some of the S's have to be non-zero. So you know these equations assume supersymmetry. Therefore, the assumption that has to be bad is that was that you had supersymmetry to begin with. Okay. So I'm done. I'm just going to say a few things to conclude. So far, the gravity solution corresponding to all of this is unknown. As Leo described last week, there's a first-order solution that's known, but so far we haven't been able to continue that solution to a full solution. It's hard to say what that actually means. If you believe all of these arguments, it suggests that there's actually some supersymmetry breaking solution the arguments that the three cycles should be blown up were just energetic arguments based on fluxes, and you expect those to still be true. So you'd expect that there would be some blown up three cycle, but perhaps where supersymmetry is broken. On the other hand, there could be some exotic solution, say where SU3 holonomy is relaxed SU3 structure, and some other assumption somewhere along the line might break down. Question? Yes.
On the flux is ISP.
In your paper they were imagine yourself to it, right?
The flux is only perturbed the solution of fluxes. Are they ISP for that person in the perturbation theory?
Yeah.
And the base doesn't change, I mean, it still remains a work.
Base is a resolve, it's a first order resolution of this Conover over the second answer. Mm-hmm. Imagine yourself here.
Okay. Without a supersymmetric vacuum, of course, all of these arguments break down. So it's not clear whether the field theory is actually a really good guide for what happens in supergravity. But there's some features of this you certainly expect to survive. However, with all of this in mind, I just want to hit the big points. So we have a relatively natural mechanism for Suzy breaking. From a rather simple model. There's a very nice geometric criterion for when this can happen, which is given by Altman's theorem, basically that you need to deform the complex structure and you can't do it. And finally, in the interest of perhaps provoking some controversy, suppose you imagine embedding this in a compact space along the lines of Gettings, Cantor, and Polchinski. Then there would be you'd be putting a Planck scale into your theory, and you'd have some warped throat. And at the bottom of the throat, you'd have supersymmetry breaking. And there'd be because of the warping, there'd be naturally a large hierarchy between the Planck scale and the supersymmetry breaking scale. And we have a large class of examples where such a mechanism could be realized. So I'll just leave that as an idea for you to think about. Yes?
Is there any known compact Calabria which has this kind of singularity?
Which?
Is there a known...
Yes.
What? This example corresponds to a known club. Yeah.
I mean, not with different gauge groups, right? Mm-hmm. But with equal gauge groups. Yes.
Yeah.
Which one is
it? Well, when I say yes, I mean it's easy to build one. I don't have one in hand.
Yeah.
The question was about compactness.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The devil's advocate. There are some flows where the field maybe the inner, I think, for example, this is a flow by which corresponds to the Bayerian deformation of Tavares structure. That's a flow basically where the base doesn't remain Calabi-Yau, and basically the flux has also stopped being ISD, and yet the solution is supersymmetric and happy. So Hartmann's theorem, which says okay, you cannot deform a Calabi-Yau, might be completely useless. I mean, maybe the fields, I mean, maybe the solution just goes completely outside of the field of Calabi-Yau solution and still remains supersymmetric. I mean, still in the supersymmetric equation might be satisfied by some other, by the flux. And the flux might actually take into, I mean,
but then it would be visible from the field theory point of view. Any way to find a different solution which would be supersymmetric would have to be compatible with the gauge theory analysis.
But in that case, the gauge theorem actually gives birth to Baryon operator. Here we always put, if I understand, we always put Baryon operator there for the deal in this analysis, is correct?
Not necessarily. You have a set of equations, and you need to solve them.
You use the assumption that the Baryon operator bears a deal.
Yeah, you can relax some of those assumptions and then try to move out along the baryonic branch. And then there are weaker arguments that suggest that you can't do that, but it's certainly not conclusive.
So you say it's not conclusive for
yeah.
the baryonic branch?
No, I mean, you have those equations must be satisfied, whether or not baryonic operators are zero. The derivation of the equations will not assume anything on the baryonic interpretation branch.
The first derivation was assuming that we don't have a baryonic. I don't understand the second one.
Well, the first one was just taking a superpotential and computing.
Then you go to the baryonic to the mesonic branch and you use
the superpotential. So to be really precise, we've shown that the mesonic branch is completely lifted, and there might be something that happens on the baryonic branch.
And this is precisely the baryonic branch.
Mm-hmm. So there might be some solution where then basically the theory is driven to the baryonic branch by force. I mean, there's no other solution. I mean, those are the last term not. And I mean, again, this is just a devil's advocate argument. I mean, again, the arguments here are quite compelling. But I mean, there's a possibility where actually the theory just goes towards one of those Baryonic branches, which has turned on. The space stops being Calabi-Yau. The supersymmetry is still okay in the way it's okay in the solution, in the Baryonic branch solution. And basically, whatever comes from the connection is cancelled by what comes from the diffuse and the dilaton. And basically, so you can still have supersymmetry, and so in a sense, the flow can still be supersymmetric with all this.
Well, Peter mentioned that as the SU3 structure scenario.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, I mean, that's basically
it. Yeah. I agree that's conceivable. It's for some subtle reasons, it's hard to imagine. But
it's just...
But it's possible.
Quite out there.
If I understand, also the Clermont structure is on the Baryon branch, it's not on the Mozart branch.
Well...
Depends.
You can put D3 brains into it, and then that puts you on the... Well, it's a mixed branch but in that case. But.
So there are mesonic operators that are taking pairs?
Well, when at the real bottom of the cascade, Yeah, you're sort of on the baryonic branch, but at the farthest point.
Okay.
Along.
There are no branches from the home.
That's right. Yes.
Can you comment on how generic you think this really is for Uber theories in general?
Oh, I think it's rather generic. It's certainly easier to have things that aren't complete intersections than complete intersections. And
intersection.
Well, not everything, but I imagine that the space of them is somewhat larger. Than
I mean, it's fairly rare for something to have a first order deformation and not have higher order.
Perhaps.
Which is what Altman's theorem gives you in this particular case.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that's a generic mechanism for supersymmetry breaking or not, I'm not sure. I mean, it's certainly a natural one.
It would also be it would be really nice to explore the space, sort of this aspect of the string theory landscape, and see, well, how generically it's realized.
For the case of non-toic?
There's a general way to measure the deformation theory, but it's hard to calculate. And if you have an example that's concrete enough that you can write equations, then I can probably calculate it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what Altman did was he formalized that calculational procedure for all of the toric cases. So for example, it's known that if you have a complete intersection, then the deformation theory is really simple. It's kind of the implication of the discussion, right? That all you have to do is add compatible terms to the various equations and you get the deformation theory. So there's no field of obstructions. I mean, to give the general answer, there is some general algebra geometric object that measures the deformations, and which has a name that's scary and I don't bother you with it.
What's the name?
It's the def functor.
Can this be generalized to cases when you have other forms? Like, you know, in supergravity, you might have forms and then have some fluxes.
This is about complex structures. And so, I mean, the theory was developed to handle the case just as traditional complex structures. It may be that it could be generalized to other cases that involve fluxes and involve these generalized complex structures, but nobody's tried to do that.
But now you can go to mathematicians and tell them that the depth factor has to be with supersymmetry breaking.
Maybe.
Well, so in the interest of telling you about silly names, but not that the depth functor is a silly name. But, what I'm going to tell you is a silly name. David Bernstein likes to call this supersymmetry breaking, by obstructed geometries. So this is the bog of supersymmetry.
bog.
Yeah. I don't think the name is called on.
What does bog swap, right?
Yeah, like
a bog and a swamp. It's true.
Bog is a swamp?
Yeah. Well, come on, get us the term swamp, isn't it?
No, but the English.
You mean the English? Yeah. It's a slight difference, but I'm not sure I can define the difference between a bog and a swamp.
So you have your landscape that has nice hills and valleys, but then you go along this direction and you wind up in a bog.
You know where the term bog comes from.
Right.
Okay.